This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, comic and actor Kumail Nanjiani and comedy writer Emily V. Gordon, co-wrote the new romantic comedy The Big Sick, which stars Kumail. The movie is based on their own relationship. Kumail grew up in Pakistan. He came to the U.S. to attend college and stayed. In the film, which is set in Chicago, as he and Emily begin seeing each other and falling in love, his parents, who are also in Chicago, are still expecting that he will enter into a traditional arranged marriage. Rather than hurt his parents and risk being cut off from his family, he keeps secret his relationship with Emily. Meanwhile, Emily is diagnosed with a life-threatening infection that requires that she be put in a medically induced coma. Emily's parents and Kumail spend time together at the hospital, sizing each other up as they worry about Emily. The coma may sound like a fictional contrivance, but it really happened. Kumail Nanjiani is perhaps best known for his role as Dinesh in the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley. Emily V. Gordon was a practicing psychotherapist for about 6 years before becoming a comedy writer. She wrote for the sitcom The Gerard Carmichael Show. Let's start with the scene from The Big Sick in which Kumail and Emily first meet. He's just done a set at a small comedy club. He walks to the bar where he sees the woman who yelled out a woohoo during his set. That woman is Emily, who in the film is played by Zoe Kazan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. My name's Kumail.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah, we saw you perform.
Now that the niceties are out of the way, I have to tell you that when you yelled at me, it really threw me off, and you really shouldn't heckle comedians. It's so rude.
I didn't heckle you. I just woohooed you. It's supportive.
Okay, that's a common misconception.
Uh-huh.
But yelling anything at a comedian is considered heckling. Heckling doesn't have to be negative.
So if I yelled out, like, you're amazing in bed, that'd be a heckle?
Yeah, it would be an accurate heckle.
Cool.
Oh.
Goodbye.
Oh. Now you can...
I'm going.
You scared my friend off now.
Kumail Nanjiani, Emily V. Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film. So Emily, my first question is to you. Did you really woohoo Kumail when he was at the mic?
That is actually one part of the film that is entirely 100% accurate. We took some creative license, of course, but that is exactly how Kumail and I met. I did woohoo him, I say helpfully, at a show. I was not a heckler before, have not been a heckler since, but that is how we met.
Did you consider it a heckle or did you consider it a way to be flirtatious?
I was kind of being funny and flirtatious. He asked a question. There was silence. I thought it would be funny to kind of, you know, respond to the question, is anyone here from Pakistan? Was quite funny. And, you know, I was kind of being a little flirtatious. Sure, why not? But I don't recommend heckling. I don't think it's a good idea overall.
Okay, we got that point. So,
yes.
Kumail, when Emily woohooed you, did you think it was flirtatious or annoying? Did you see it as a heckle or as helpful?
It certainly wasn't helpful. What I remember is her going woohoo, me looking at her and seeing this very, very pretty girl and being like, oh, she's cute. And so I was charmed by it rather than being upset by it. I think it's more the messenger than the message.
So you both write comedy, but your life isn't a comedy. So you've turned a difficult period of your life into comedy, the period when Emily was in a medically induced coma. So how did you go about trying to find the comedy there? You know, because you still managed to keep it as a comedy even during the rough periods like that period of the film.
I think part of what helps is that because we had been through it, anything that we wrote that was kind of added, you know, fictionalized parts or added new scenes, we knew the emotional truth of what happened and we knew that we didn't want to disrespect what actually happened and the seriousness of the kind of being in a medically induced coma. So I think that helped us just as a mindset to go in, not kind of writing anything that would have felt disrespectful or off base or kind of off color for the movie. That being said, that was something Judd was really great about encouraging us to do was...
This is Judd Apatow.
Kind of, yeah. Judd Apatow, who helped us produce the movie, was that you write the movie out, kind of put everything out there, and he was like, don't worry about the comedy. The comedy will come, which I think was really good advice.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, generally, comedy is a person in trouble. It's a person dealing with a situation that they're ill-equipped to handle. And we knew that the real-life event, no matter how traumatic, was basically us, me and her parents, dealing with an event that we weren't equipped to handle, which is the person we're all in love with being very, very ill. So we knew that the general construction of it could be comedic. We just had to figure out specifically how could we make it a comedy without losing the reality level of a very young woman being very ill.
Emily, would you explain why you were in a medically induced coma?
Yes, absolutely. I had been sick for a little while, and people kept telling me I had the flu, I had pneumonia, I was having panic attacks. None of that kind of seemed right to me.
But you weren't having panic attacks.
No, they I certainly was not.
You were,
that's what
yeah.
I'm saying. They kept, every time I went in, they were diagnosing me with something different, and all I knew is that I just felt quite awful, and I couldn't seem to catch my breath. So by the time I went to the doctor, and they decided to admit me to the hospital because my breathing was so unstable that they wanted to kind of check me out in a hospital. And by the time I got there, my breathing was so unstable, as was my heart rate, that the only thing they could do to kind of keep me safe and kind of keep my vitals stabilized was to put me on a respirator. And you should not be on a respirator while you were conscious. So that was why they put me in a medically induced coma.
Yeah, they had to take pressure off of Emily's body so they would put some of the vital functions on machines so that her body wasn't taxed. I remember when I got to the hospital, Emily was in the ER, and I went in and I was talking to her, and the nurse came in, and the nurse, first thing she said to, she was holding reports, and she said to me, or to Emily, she said, "Oh, you're a very sick girl." And I was like, "What? What does that mean? She doesn't really look that sick."
Gosh, a respirator, it does its job, but it's very terrifying to watch somebody on a respirator. It makes a lot of noise. It's basically breathing for you. So you hear, you know, the inhale and the exhale that the respirator's creating. And it seems like it's a very invasive kind of machine. There's, a tube down your throat?
All the way down your throat. It's incredibly invasive. I, for many years, had a hard time even looking at anyone on television or in movies that had one in their mouths. It's like, even though you're not conscious for it, some part of you must be, because it's quite traumatic, for sure.
Camille, did you talk to her while she was in coma?
Yeah, the nurse actually really encouraged us to talk to her because they said that she could hear. So we would talk to her pretty often, her parents and I. We would sort of keep her updated and just tell her what was happening in the news and what was happening with, like, celebrity gossip and stuff. So
I really appreciated that.
Yeah, we would talk to her all the time. I think I ran some jokes by her.
Did not get a good response.
Not a good response.
And Emily, so people were assuming, like, your parents, Camille, were assuming that maybe you could hear them even though you were in a coma, so they would talk to you so that you would know that they were there and be comforted by that. Did you know that they were there? Could you hear them? Do you have any memory of hearing them?
I absolutely do. I think, and, you know, I think it's partially because I was in a medically induced coma, so I don't know what it's like for other people, but I was very well aware that both Camille and my parents were there in the room with me. I could kind of hear snatches of what they were saying. I had constructed an elaborate backstory for my plight that involved Camille being sick. I thought Camille was in a hospital and that I was visiting him. So I clearly had some level of awareness of what was happening, but
it was like this extended dream you were having.
Yeah, which to me I thought was only like a day or two long. I didn't really have a sense of time so much, but my brain was trying to make sense of things, so I could definitely hear them. Not the entire time, but I could hear them.
Once she was out, we were talking about it a few weeks later, and she was talking about the doctor. Actually, no, she was still in the hospital, but she'd been awake and she was pretty lucid by this point. And she was telling me about, she's like, "What is the doctor with the sticky candy hands?" And that happened because, you know, she had all this tape on her and she was getting prodded with needles. So even while she was in the coma, she could feel people sort of putting sticky tape on her. And so she, in her dream state, had this doctor who had, you know, sticky candy.
Jolly Rancher. They were Jolly Rancher hands. I don't know if that's, we can say brand names, but they were Jolly Rancher hands.
Yeah, Jolly Rancher hands.
When I didn't think he was a real person, I wasn't asking if he was around. I in my head, I just had, one of my doctors had Jolly Rancher hands in my head.
You know what this is reminding me of? You know, in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy's in a, you know, basically in a coma, and she has this whole elaborate fantasy about Oz that she's dreaming until she gets out of the coma, and the people in real life are the models for the characters in Oz.
Yeah. So, and you were there. And you were there.
Exactly. and sticky hands, you were there.
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly right.
So, you know, I've always wanted to ask this to someone. Emily, what's it like when you come out of coma? Like, what's the first feeling that you have?
I was pretty out of it for the first couple of days, and I remember being just incredibly confused. And not super proud to admit this, my confusion led to kind of frustration and anger. I was quite angry because it seemed like everyone around me was very, very happy. And we actually, this ended up in the movie. Everyone around me was so excited, and I was like, guys, something awful's happened to me. Why are you guys so excited? But they had been dealing with something much worse happening to me and were excited that I was now conscious, whereas I was just catching up to what had been happening. So I was like furious and kind of crying all the time. A lot of strangers were coming in the room to like tell me how excited they were that I was awake. And I just, I was not, I did not greet them with the most, I was not the most gracious human being, I'll say, at the beginning. And so it took me a little while to kind of get comfortable with what had happened to me. I just needed time to catch up. I also had very little short-term memory, so they basically had to tell me every day for a couple of days that I had been in a coma, which I was unaware of every single time. So it was really pretty overwhelming, and traumatic is maybe a little too strong of a word, but it was a lot of catching up to do.
I think describing a medically induced coma as traumatic isn't overstated yet. I think that might be an appropriate term. The Emily mentioned that people were coming in to say hi to her. That was because Emily was by far the youngest person in the ICU at that time. So all the family members of all the other patients were very aware of Emily. So they were all kind of rooting for her. And so they were very excited. They were very excited when she was up because they just wanted her to get out of the ICU.
So in the film, when you come out of the coma, everyone is told that you're going to be especially honest because of all the drugs in your system. So is that a fact? I mean, does that actually happen?
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
It is also true that I tend to be a little loosey-goosey. I'm quite informal with my parents. I have a lovely kind of relationship with them. But I definitely had weird things. Like, I thought that ice had different fruit flavors, and I was trying to encourage people to try the ice in my room and in the drink that I had. But I just was a little maybe saying inappropriate things.
All the time. I mean, that there's a line in the movie where she says, when she has the thickened liquid, that she says, it tastes like something that I don't want to name. That's something Emily said.
Oh, I said that?
Yeah, you said that. And the doctor had said, just so you know, her social inhibitions are going to be sort of down while she comes off this medication. So Emily was really...
That's so funny. I thought I came up with that line, like a clever, funny, like, what a great... I thought I came up with it when writing the script. I didn't realize I'd actually said that line.
Yeah.
Great. because the thing is, when you have a respirator... Oh, God. This is not what I dream for myself on NPR. When you are on a respirator, your esophagus gets really weak, and so they won't let you have liquids that are normal liquids because you're too weak to even swallow normal liquids. So everything I drank had this, like, thickened, like, gelatinous quality. Oh, God. So, yes, that is a line in the movie. Oh, boy.
So how did this, like, medical nightmare affect your relationship? You were not yet engaged when this happened?
Oh, not even a little bit.
No, yeah. Not at all. I remember. So, you know, I was sort of going through a lot of stuff with my own family. So I hadn't really thought about the future of this relationship in any way. And I remember, this sounds like a movie moment, but it really, really isn't. It's completely 100% true. When they put her in the coma, I was there alone at the hospital. I got there at night, they put her in the coma at about 5 a.m., which I watched. They should not have let me watch it. I remember seeing her laying there in the coma for the first time, and I remember having the thought, if she comes out of this, I'm going to marry her. And I know that there's some consent issues with that, but I'm just...
I'm going to ask her to marry me.
I will, and I hope she says yes.
Yes.
That's right, yeah.
How long did it take to actually ask?
Well, that's funny that you asked that question. We got married 3 months after I got out of the hospital, but like many things we do, instead of it being kind of like there was no moment that he proposed to me as much as we just kind of talked about it. And we were like, we're getting married.
We never got engaged. We just got
married. Yeah, we just were like, well, that's it. We're getting married. In kind of this like fever haze just a few months after I got out of the hospital. But there was no... Well, you did propose later.
Yeah. It didn't seem like a fever haze. At the time, it seemed like a very rational decision. But if you add up all these so-called rational decisions we'd made within 3 months of this, it maybe amounts to a fever haze because we had both quit our jobs, we had gotten married, and we'd moved to New York within 3 months of this event. So it clearly affected us. And what Emily was referring to was, you know, we got married, we walked into a city hall in Chicago with 4 or 5 of our closest friends, and we got married, and then we went and got brunch, stood in line. It was a Saturday, so, you know, there was a 40-minute wait.
We thought we could skip the line because we just gotten married, but no. We're like, would you like some juice? Sure, we'll take some juice.
We got free orange juice, not very much of it. It was like a shot glass of orange juice.
So, Kamal, in the film, your parents, who are from Pakistan, live nearby. You all live in Chicago. And they're always trying to set up an arranged marriage for you with a Pakistani woman. And every time you come over for dinner, it's like, surprise, look who's here. And it's always like a young, single Pakistani woman who just happened to stop by in the and your parents are hoping that this will be the one that you will marry. Was this an issue for your family? That did they want you to have an arranged marriage like they had?
Oh, yes, definitely. That was the narrative from the very beginning. I remember since I was a little kid, my mom showing me jewelry and being like, "This, I'll give this to the wife that I find for you." You know, it's I feel like people here sort of think of arranged marriage as sort of this old world thing, but it really is. It's just the way that everybody in my family did it. My parents, obviously, but all my aunts, uncles, most of my cousins are arranged married, you know, and the...
All very happy marriages.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the method has evolved over time. I've seen it change in front of me. When I was a kid, I know the story of how my parents got married, and I saw my older cousins getting married, and now I know how people get married now. And it's evolved a little bit. It's become more technological in some ways, but it's definitely still arranged marriage.
So did they know that you didn't want to do that?
You know, it's interesting you ask because I really led them on. I never said no to it. Sort of how in the movie I'm just sort of avoiding making these decisions, and avoiding making decisions is what hurts the people around me. That's kind of what I was doing in real life. I just was saying, no, not this one, not this one, not this girl, not her, not her. So they would send me emails and they would call and be like, hey, you remember that aunt whose house we went to when you were 12? Do you remember that little girl that was there? Anyway, now she's of a certain age. What do you think of her? And they would send me pictures. And I actually recently found one of my mom's emails to me. And it was during the period that Emily and I were dating. And reading the email chain was kind of devastating because I saw how I was clearly leading them on and letting them think that I was going to do it. Honestly, at the time, I couldn't imagine a world where I did have an arranged marriage, and I couldn't imagine a world where I didn't have an arranged marriage.
Where does that leave you if you can't imagine either?
That's a great question.
It just leaves me in the middle. I mean, that's, you know, when we were writing the script, Judd Apatow was like, so what was the plan? What were you going to do? And I was like, I don't know. I had no plan. I just wasn't thinking about it. I was just kind of living day to day. There really was no strategy. It's horrifying.
Kamal, how did you tell your parents about Emily?
So it did, while she was really sick, it had been, I forget, you know, what day it was or when it was. And I sort of remember where I was. My parents had been calling me just sort of to say hi to me all week, and I hadn't been answering the phone. And then one day when, you know, because being in the hospital was a roller coaster. Some days were good, some days were bad. But actually, every day was good and bad because you'd meet with all these doctors, and somebody would say something that would give you all this hope, and then someone would come and shatter all hope. So it was in one of those sort of troughs, one of those valleys, where my mom called me, and I just sort of answered the phone, and I just needed...
You wanted your mom.
Yeah, I just needed my mom. So that's when I told her on the phone.
What was her reaction?
In the moment, her reaction was, is she, what's wrong with her? Is she going to be okay? Are you okay? And then she sort of checked up on Emily every day, called me every day. And then as soon as Emily was out of the coma, that's when she got really angry. She was like, how could you do this to me? But while Emily was sick, she just wanted to make sure Emily was okay. And then she got angry later.
You know, the whole how could you do this to me thing when it comes from a parent about your relationship, it puts the child in such a bind. I mean, you have to live your life the way you've chosen to live it, but you don't want that choice to hurt your parents and to be perceived as something that you've done to hurt them. And so it leaves you with this impossible choice. Do you not live your life the way you think it should be lived to avoid hurting your parents? Or do you do what you think is the right thing to do, knowing it's going to hurt your parents? It's pain. Yeah, it's like pain in either direction.
Well, and it's especially tough for immigrant families, I think, because, you know, a lot of immigrant families will come here and the parents sort of take the hit, right? They lose their jobs, they start over, they get jobs that are much worse than the jobs they had. They sort of sacrifice their own lives to give their children better lives. And then a lot of times, their children don't choose the lives that the parents want for them. So they're kind of getting it both ways. It's very tricky because I understand my parents. I understand why they wanted me to marry someone within the culture, right? Because they're here and they want to hold on to their identity and they want to hold on to their culture. And one of the most important ways to do it is to sort of pass it on to your kids. And then having your kid choose someone outside the culture, I understand. You know, it's a struggle. It's difficult to hold on to your identity in a land where your identity is not valued.
So is everything okay now in the family?
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I realized I had not given my parents enough credit. I just, you know, it's easy to think of your parents as being the people that they will always be and that they're sort of done, you know, they're always going to be these people. But I had not given them, thought that they would have the capacity to evolve and change in the way that they really have. It's been, you know, I just did not give them enough credit.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you, and be well.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. This was such a thrill. We were so excited to be here.
Thank you.
Kumail Nanjiani and Emily V. Gordon wrote the screenplay for the new romantic comedy, The Big Sick, which stars Kumail. Most dancers and athletes face a similar predicament. Their careers are virtually over in their late 30s or 40s. And then what? At the age of 47, my guest Wendy Whalen, who was described in the New York Times as America's greatest contemporary ballerina, faced the end of her career as a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet after a hip injury required surgery and months of rehabilitation and physical therapy. Against the odds, she was able to return to the company in the spring of 2014 and then gave her final performance that fall. Retirement was inevitable even without the injury. 47 is considered old for a ballet dancer, and her style of contemporary ballet was like an extreme sport. While dancing, she seemed to defy both the law of gravity and the physical limitations of the human body. Retiring was a personal and professional crisis. Her life, her work, her identity revolved around the New York City Ballet, which she had danced with for 30 years. She's lucky. She can still dance in spite of the injury she sustained. But now she does contemporary dance. A new documentary called Restless Creature covers the period of her life from her surgery to her final bow at the ballet. Restless Creature is also the name of the first independent dance project that she performed. In the fall, she'll tour with new works choreographed for her in a project called Sum of a Thousand Words. Wendy Whalen, welcome to Fresh Air. I know leaving the New York City Ballet was very difficult for you. It had been your life, your identity. Did it make it any easier to have a camera crew documenting that period of your life and being public about it, making it something interesting and worthy of sharing, something other people, dancers and other people, would identify with?
That's a great question. It was a very difficult time. I did not want to make the film originally when it came my way. I didn't want to share this very unknown part of my life, unknown to me, complicated and confusing and very vulnerable. But I was sort of talked into it. I was talked into trying it, and I liked the footage that I saw, and I liked the directors and filmmakers that I was working with. And especially the cameraman. He had done dance films before, so it was very comfortable. He knew exactly how to move in the studio or wherever I was with me. And because it was such a difficult time, it turned into a supportive thing in a way. It was at times irritating to have a camera crew around me, but at the same time, it pushed me to bare myself, open my story up, and to do it with confidence and to do it in a creative way.
Was it a kind of a preventive against wallowing?
I think it kind of turned into that. Yeah, it was a support. It turned into that in a weird way.
My impression is you felt you might have been violating an unspoken ballet rule, which is that ballet dancers don't reveal their difficulties.
Exactly.
Where does that come from? Like, what is that about?
I don't know. It's this ideal of perfection, of otherworldliness, of power and strength and confidence. That's what we try to emit on the stage. You know, there humor comes in, creativity comes in, and there's quite a bit of mess, but we don't want to show that to an audience. So that's part of the game. That's part of the thrill of it, to be a ballet dancer.
And here you were on camera showing physical problems, showing pain.
Yeah. One of the hard things for me to do was to show my limp to the camera and to show myself crying. I'm not a crying kind of person anyway. And I knew that the camera people wanted some tears. Every once in a while, they wanted the reality. They wanted me to viscerally show what I was feeling. And it was very hard for me to do that. The very few times I cried through the whole experience, it's in the film. So... and there was a time that happened probably halfway through the filming where I had difficulty walking. My leg wouldn't accept the weight without a buckle. And so dancing was a really big question. And that was really hard for me to show. And I actually took a break from the filming at that moment. I needed to get some epidurals in my back, and I just was like, I just need some space. And I actually learned how to meditate during that time. I just had the cameras leave.
What were your biggest worries about what your life would be like if you couldn't dance again?
Well, I didn't want to lose the voice I had physically, the mode of expression that I had, and I knew it so well. You know, it's just like having a voice or having a talent at writing and then losing a part of that, losing a vocal cord or losing access to your, you know, hand to write it down. It was terrifying to lose that mode of expression that I was so in touch with, that I so loved, that I so cultivated for my whole entire life.
And it was your entire life. I mean, that was dancing, was and still is your life.
Yeah, I started when I was 3, and I retired ballet at 47, but I'm 50 now, and I just took class, and I did yoga this morning, and I moved my body, and I felt good. So I was happy about that.
That's nice to hear. So yeah. Once you realized after your hip surgery and after the rehabilitation and physical therapy, once you realized you could dance again, but it was time to leave the extreme dance of the New York City Ballet, did it change your identity to leave the New York City Ballet? You'd been with that ballet for 30 years. You were a principal. That was really like your identity. And it's one of the most famous ballet companies in the world.
Yeah. I moved to New York from Louisville, Kentucky when I was 15. My ultimate focus was the New York City Ballet, getting in, hopefully, and thriving in that company. And I did. I was there as an apprentice when I was 17, joined when I was 19, and grew up there. Everything I experienced as an adult happened as a member of New York City Ballet, so it all connects to that place. So to leave it as an adult, going into it as basically a child, was scary, really scary.
Yeah, I mean, like, who are you if you're not the principal of the New York City Ballet?
Yeah, and, you know, they give us our schedule a day or 2 days before, so I know every day what I'm supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And leaving New York City Ballet, the world doesn't do that for me. You know, I have to do that myself. So that was huge to let myself know, oh, well, if you want to sleep in, you can sleep in. You know, that was like, what? You know, just letting go and releasing and relaxing a little bit was huge.
Was letting go hard? I mean, was that something you didn't really know how to do?
I've been strapped in, you know, physically strapped in to pointe shoes, strapped into a leotard and tights. My hair has been strapped up for my whole entire life. And to untie the shoes, I don't wear a leotard anymore. I wear a t-shirt and I wear pants. I don't wear tights. I generally wear my hair looser or even in a braid now. I wear socks on my feet. I don't like to be constricted now, but that was safe then. I was terrified to be unconstricted, and now I don't know another way I'd rather be. So, yeah, it was from one extreme, finding the safety in the other.
When you were describing how you dress, are you talking about on stage or off?
Both, on stage and off. I wake up, I go to class at 10:30 in the morning. I have a leotard on and tights on and shoes, and my hair is up. And I spend that day like that. I rehearse all day, then I go and do a performance, and everything becomes a little bit tighter, you know, including the nervous system. So everything's on a high ladder of like, you know, I've gotta succeed. I can't falter. I have to, you know, make that step happen. I have to feel in the zone in front of 3,000 people tonight. And then coming off of that from a performance takes a while. Your adrenaline is pumped and you calm down, and maybe you go to sleep at midnight or 1, or if you can't sleep because you're nervous later than that, and then you get up and you do it all again the next day. I did that for decades. And I don't consider myself a ballerina now. I've given it up. I've let it go. And it's life. And we all have to do that at some point. And
it's hard sometimes to do it in our culture because I think people are ashamed of getting older.
They're ashamed, definitely.
People don't hide their age the way they used to because it's pointless. All anybody needs to do is go on Google. So what?
Exactly.
Why bother to hide it? But
yeah.
But still, I think people are very often very self-conscious about their age, especially in professions where you're judged by your age. And that covers a lot of professions. But when you're judged visually by your age, I mean, I'm sure that's one of the reasons why so many people get cosmetic surgery, you know?
I've always been proud, I'm this old. I've never lied about my age, and I've, you know, so. And,
yeah, but at the ballet, it must have been like, well, I don't know, she's 45 now. When is she going to retire? How much more does she have left? Did you feel that from people?
I heard later in my career my boss say, you're going to outlast some of your colleagues. Just physically, I can tell. And so I was revved up about that. I felt confident. Yeah, I am. You know, I sure am. And I did. But then at the same time, he's the one that said, okay, now maybe you should rethink doing this particular role or this particular thing. And, you know, he's kind of the master of time, Mr. Time.
What was your mix between anger and gratitude when he told you, maybe it's no longer time for you to be doing this role? And I think the role he was talking about was in The Nutcracker, which you'd done every year.
Yeah. I was surprised. I went into the meeting thinking it was about something else. I had no idea that this was going to come up.
And this was a meeting with the ballet master, Peter Martins.
Yeah. And because I hadn't had any real pain in my body. I mean, I knew I wasn't 28 anymore, but at the same time, I wasn't feeling pain and or boredom I still felt inspired. And so when it happened, I was just like, what? Are you serious? It shocked me. And then it hurt really, really bad. And I cried a lot for a while. And I think the shock was what hurt the most because I didn't expect it.
You know, a lot of people think of ballet as being the ultimate in, like, femininity. You know, like, a pink kind of femininity, like frilly, yeah. The tutu. Mm-hmm. Your approach at New York City Ballet was it's almost like more of an extreme sport. I mean, you got your body into shapes and angles and doing jumps and getting lifted in ways that truly seem to defy the laws of gravity and defy the laws of what the body is physically capable of. Would you describe a little for people who have not seen you dance some of the things that you did that were so typical for you but not typical for others?
Right. Well, I can take it back to when I was a kid. I was a very athletic child, very energetic child, and that's why I started dancing. It was, I had a little too much energy. My mom said, let's get the middle child out of the house in the afternoon and let's stick her somewhere where she can release that energy. So she put me into ballet. And my mom was a basketball coach, a college women's basketball coach. So very serious basketball family. I wanted to be an athlete first. I wanted to also be an artist. I was really good at drawing, and I wanted to either grow up and be an athlete or an artist. Unbeknownst to me, ballet was both. And again, when I very first saw the Nutcracker, the dance that appealed to me was not the Sugar Plum Fairy. It was not the Waltz of the Flowers. It was the Arabian dance. It was the muscular, the sinuous, more almost modern dance of the Nutcracker. That's the part I wanted to be. I didn't care for the pinkness of ballet. I never did. I was drawn immediately as a student at the School of American Ballet to seeing my first performances of the New York City Ballet. My first ballets that I loved were the Stravinsky ballets. And a lot of those Stravinsky ballets have a plucky quality or a pulled-out quality or a very angular quality, something that's not soft, something that's not voluptuous in a feminine kind of way. It's voluptuous in a geometrical kind of way. So mm-hmm. Geometry, athleticism, stark angles, that's me.
So you started dancing at the age of 3?
Yes.
And by 12, you were diagnosed with scoliosis. How severe was it?
Severe enough that the doctors wanted to treat me for it with traction, body casting, and ultimately a Milwaukee brace. So they wanted to halt the curve, because if they didn't halt the curve when they found it, the curve probably would have accelerated to a place where I would have needed surgery, which ultimately would not have allowed me to have a ballet career. So we caught it really right at the crux of it either getting worse without treatment or halting and responding to treatment. And being a dancer was a great thing. The doctor told me back then, he said, the best things for scoliosis, this was in 1979 or 1980, are swimming and ballet. I was like, great. And therefore, my body was flexible enough that it really responded to the treatment quickly. I grew an inch and a half after a week of traction in the hospital, and the doctors were thrilled. And that really kind of pulled me away from the surgery side of things, whereas one of my hospital roommate didn't get so lucky, and she ended up having to get a rod in her spine.
So when you had to wear a body cast, mm-hmm. how did you keep up with dancing?
Well, I was in a 15-pound body cast. So imagine one of those down vests that you can get at North Face or one of the, basically that made out of plaster was what I lived in for, it ended up being a month at a time over 5 months one summer. And in between each casting, I would go back into the hospital and spend a week in traction with a head halter on and leather straps holding my hips down towards the base of the bed. And 12 pounds pulling on my head on this head halter. So as uncomfortable as that was, it really helped me straighten out my back. And then I would go into this body cast for a month at a time. And my teacher said to me at the time, living in Louisville, Kentucky, she said, you know, you've done so well, and I don't want you to lose your focus during this treatment right now. So I want you to come into the studio in your body cast, and I want you to try to do whatever you can do. We don't expect you to do this. We don't expect you to do that. But just feel it out. Move your body. Keep your brain focused on what we're talking about in the class so that you just stay connected. And that was paramount. That shaped my whole life.
In talking about your early career, you've said that you didn't think of yourself as beautiful, and ballerinas are supposed mm-hmm. to be beautiful. You thought of getting your nose redone. Mm-hmm. What was your thought process like in trying to decide whether to do that or not? And I'll say here, you rejected the idea of getting work done on your face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't really know my beauty. I was a tomboy kid. I didn't have a family that, you know, makeup was, you know, part of our family. It just wasn't. And even my teachers were like, oh, don't wear makeup. Go to New York and let them make you. And the minute I got to New York, they were like, put lipstick on. Here's some mascara. You know, let's fix you. Because, you know, I just didn't know. And I let them shape me. And again, I also learned about my beauty through Balanchine's work and how I fit into his ballets, what qualities I had in his work physically, within my face, within my musculature. Yeah, it took time for me. It wasn't a natural thing that I just, oh, here's my hairdo and here's my makeup. You know, years and years of other dancers, older dancers, let me try your makeup tonight, Wendy. Come to my makeup spot and I'll do your makeup tonight. So I literally, my big sisters, these girls at the ballet.
The documentary about you, the new documentary, Restless Creature, ends with an excerpt of your final New York City ballet performance. And then when you take your bow, like, everybody's coming up with a bouquet of roses. You have so many bouquets of roses at some point, you put them down, and they just look like two, they're bigger than you are.
Yeah.
They look like too heavy to even carry at some point.
Yeah.
What was it like waking up the next day? Do you remember that?
It was funny. Yeah, my niece was there. She was, I think, 3 or 4 at the time. And we were pretending with a cat toy that we were fishing. You know, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm in retirement now. I'm fishing, you know. It's like, yeah. And even on stage, I just felt like, you know, I bowed for nearly a half an hour. I don't remember quite how long, but people are like, you were bowed a long time at the end of your show. And I felt slowly like I was taking a skin off, like this kind of snake skin. Like, I am now me. And you're seeing me, the goofy Wendy, just I'm not trying to be who you all thought I was for so long. You know, I'm just this girl. And I jumped like a little kid, you know, a little bit. And I had like bad posture and I was like walking like a normal person in my bows. And I was like, yeah, I'm just a human being. And I've been this the whole time, but I haven't been able to show it.
Did it feel like there was a big gap between how you saw yourself as like just Wendy and how you saw yourself on stage?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the process of letting go was a couple of years in the making. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I worked for those years to get to that last show and be able to retire with grace and not a bitterness or a sadness, mm-hmm. but with a humility and a gratitude.
There's a moment in the film where you talk about how you can't watch the New York City Ballet because it's just too painful since you can't dance at that point. You're still recovering.
Yeah. So, well, that was, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But do you still have to deal at all with envy or, no? Like when you see like young dancers or when you look at the dancers in the New York City Ballet, do you wish like you could be back there, that you could be that again?
Mm-mm. I did it and I'm so proud of how I did it and I'm proud of how I let it go and I'm excited for these people that are in it now, loving it, living it, being it, finding themselves. I'm finding myself in a new, different place mm-hmm. now, which is exciting. I would never want to go back. No.
Why not?
Into time?
Yeah.
Because I'm fascinated with where I'm at now. You know, I've done it. I lived it. I learned to let it go, which was a great learning, spiritual learning experience for me as a person. And now all these new challenges, all these new question marks, all this new stuff I've never done, the fear, the anxiety, the excitement, the release of it, the new way I can approach it with where I'm at now, that's fascinating to me now.
Well, I can't tell you how much I admire you. Thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been great to talk with you.
Thank you. It's been a thrill.
There's a new documentary about Wendy Whalen. It's called Restless Creature. In the fall, Whalen will tour with new works choreographed for her in a project called Sum of a Thousand Words. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.